The Unconventional Therapist's Guide to Nothing.
Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Dave. I am one of the two unconventional therapists, and I am here with my arch enemy and co-host, Greg.
Your shadow?
No.
Oh.
You wish.
Well, I mean, shadow and...
Greg, why would I ever put you in that category?
I don't know. Between us, there was an evil side, who would it be? I think it would have to be you.
The evil side?
Yeah.
Oh, please, dude. I'm all benevolence.
Yeah, I know, dude. You say that as your backdrop is a Ouija board. So it's, I don't know. You're sending mixed messages.
Oh, boy.
You are an eccentric, though. And
I would never want to call someone a shadow, though. Because when I think of shadow, I don't think of a counterpart. I think of, like, you're Scottie Pippen and I'm Michael Jordan, you know?
Oh, yeah. Like, sort of Peter Pan and his shadow. But nothing like that at all. You're thinking like sort of the Wing Beneath My Wings song. I've always had a problem with that. Like, you know,
I'm thinking like I'm Justin Timberlake and you're all the rest of NSYNC.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, that's not what I mean by that. And we'll get into what I mean by that because the shadow is actually an incredibly important part of the person. But you know, Dave, as I mentioned before, you are an eccentric type person. Do you disagree?
Eccentric makes me feel like you're calling me like Kramer.
Well,
you think I'm Kramer?
No. So, let me see if you still think this is an insult. So, the best example I can give, I guess, is like, you know, the Jackson family. You would be Michael.
No.
Okay. No good for you?
No.
All right. Well, I'm sorry.
Wow.
I felt like that was a compliment. Standout. Different. Wow. Different, right?
I don't even know. There's so many directions to go here.
Well, Dave, most groups.
You know, I always thought of myself as like, if we were like a duo, I'm Notorious B.I.G. and you're P. Diddy.
P. Diddy? I thought you were going to say Tupac, and I was like, I agree.
That's what you do. I mean, you basically, I'm just like saying, like, that's the equivalent of what you just said to me.
No, what I'm saying is if you get a group of people together, there's usually an oddball. And okay, this is not, I'm not doing myself any favors here. So you know, one that strays from the path, but you know, so one could say weird. So sure. One could say oddball, and I did. And I'm sorry that came out, but you could also say genius, right? So
you could.
Let's say you could. So I'm not saying we're going to.
That's not the gist I was getting.
Well, all right. Let me do this then in terms that we and our listeners can understand. If you line up Freud, Frankel, Beck, Rogers, Maslow, Adler, all these guys, you got this straight lace group. But then who's their Michael Jackson? Their esoteric, mysterious counterpart. That to me is Carl Jung and Dave.
Yeah.
Right? All right. So listen.
So Greg, obviously this is a psychology episode and you were doing this little setup intro. Somehow we're going to come to a conclusion that this episode's about Carl Jung.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Greg, you've been wanting to do this episode for quite a while, right?
I have.
And you are very excited about this?
I am.
And it's killing you that I'm slowing down your momentum right now.
It really is.
I actually, Greg, I meant to tell you this. Like, I really think that we should consider doing video for our podcast on YouTube. We already got the YouTube channel going. Why not supplement it with our just video? And maybe we get some cool backdrop that makes
sense. Yeah, I would actually love that. Especially, I think that, you know, if we shine a little light on you, Shadow Man, there is a pretty face for people to see.
Well, I think
that's going to be a draw.
I think video needs to happen just for moments like this so that they can actually see what it looks like when Greg is like boiling on the inside because I am slowing down this momentum and he wants to hurry up and get into the topic of the day.
The awesome topic.
The awesome topic. So Greg.
Yeah.
Today was a big day. I'm just going to do this on purpose now. Today was a pretty big day, though.
Are you talking about the eclipse?
Of course I am.
Yeah. Yeah, so, real interesting stuff. What is this, a science podcast now?
This is a psychological phenomena that happened today.
Mm.
People were going bonkers. And did you watch any of the news coverage?
No.
Did you see anything on the... Did you watch the eclipse?
I know the birds were real upset.
Okay.
Worried.
Did you even notice that it happened? Did you notice it got slightly darker?
You know, can I be honest? I didn't even notice that it didn't really get dark. I was looking out the window. At times.
Okay. So it was streaming online when it was happening, and you could see it happen from like, it started in Indianapolis. I caught it when it's in Indianapolis. They showed when it was happening. Then they switched over and they were in like, where was it? Lake Placid, I think. And then they were somewhere else, whatever. The news anchors are trying to make this. It's interesting. And it's like the first time in 30 years that it's happened here. Right. But they were trying to make it this like really big, like exciting thing. But it's literally just the sun being blocked by the moon.
Yeah.
And they almost started crying while they were describing it. And they were talking about like how like one's like, I got the hairs on my neck are standing up. And another guy's like, this is like making me reminding me of the connectedness of all of us here. And it was like it felt kind of weird because I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if it felt authentic or not, but also part of it kind of was like, well, this is actually kind of crazy. People were going nuts to watch it. And it's like everybody's collectively excited for it.
Well, I think that what's cool is, there's two things that are like, one's disheartening because I saw people literally holding up their phone watching it. But I get that was to record it and everything. You can't look directly at it. But there's this short story I read one time where it was like, the stars would only come out once every 100 years. So everyone would come out and look at it. And we live in a world where the stars are out every single night. And I just feel like we miss so much of these. I think it's cool that there's a sense of wonderment around these things. And we should do that more, right? We should use this as an example to be like, yeah, let's like enjoy some of these natural phenomena that are happening all around us all the time. Because there's a lot of beauty that we're missing out on staring at our computers and our phones and whatever. At least yeah. If you listen to podcasts, you can see everything and enjoy your media, you know?
Sure. Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's really cool to see everybody having this like enthusiasm over something so like, you know, natural and that we can all enjoy. And then the other part of it was like nostalgia was hitting hard because like the last time this happened was 94, right? I kind of remember it. I was sharing this with my family today. I was like, I was in third grade. I think we were all excited. Like the teachers were making us make these like, I think we made our own sunglasses to look at it. And I was like, how come no one's doing that? Why? Like there was a big thing with like a shortage of sunglasses. How come they're not making them like we used to? And that probably wasn't safe. That's why.
Yeah.
We probably shouldn't have used the ones we used back then. But
kids lost their vision that day.
Yes. But like, remember in the 90s and 80s when like NASA and space were like cool and exciting? And I feel like that's not like, I feel like it's coming back a little bit. You see a lot of clothing with like the NASA logo, but like, it was different. Like we were super into like the planets and like space just felt exciting.
Yeah.
I don't think that's, and I got a little sense of that today again, like space and the universe and stuff like that. It was cool. I loved it. I was like, wow, I used to actually like that stuff. And I kind of forgot about that, I guess. So a little bit of nostalgia today. And also, I guess, yeah, even though it sounded crazy when that guy was saying it on the news, it's true, though. It is like a collected, a connectedness that we all had today.
Yeah.
People who were excited.
It's like when Fievel and his, weirdly, I think his sister were singing Somewhere Out There to each other and just both looking at the same moon.
Right before he went west.
That's right. That's right.
Fievel goes
all right. Can I talk about Carl Jung now?
Sure.
Because, Dave, he is, what's important, there's so many important things about Carl Jung, but one thing is, anybody who says they're like a Jungian analyst or a Jungian, I don't know, that would be really hard to be and sort of disingenuous. But what I think we all have to say as therapists is we, you know, whether you're existentialist, humanist, gestalt, psychodynamic, whatever, even CBT, we all use components of his work, right? His belief that everything has meaning and resonates and everyone should have some sort of spirituality in his life. This is part of everything. What's also interesting is that, and what sets him apart from Freud, his colleague and at a time friend, is that he wasn't married to his theories like Freud was. They changed as he changed. He, you know, as he aged, he kept an open mind, which is kind of nice, but which makes him really prolific and really kind of hard to use his theory as, you know, a tangible sort of framework for therapy. But that doesn't mean that it's not super useful. So he's also, he doesn't really, all right. The thing about Jung is it's not easy. When he talks about the self, it's really hard to kind of decipher what he's talking about because his ideas about the self are constantly moving and difficult to understand. So we'll get into that a lot when we start talking about archetypes and other setups and everything like that. But before we get into all that, let me kind of give a brief biography.
Yeah, tell the people who he is. There's so many people probably listening to this. Like, who are you talking about? And why should I listen?
Well, we'll let you know. Born in 1875 in Switzerland, so not in Vienna.
Forget it. I'm not listening anymore.
I know. I'm going to be quick with this stuff. The boring stuff. I'm just kidding. But the only reason why I mentioned he was born in Switzerland, because he was. Also,
So it's facts.
It's facts and not Vienna, like the rest of the real jogs that we've covered already, you know, not like Adler, Frankel, and Freud, right? His father was a minister. So this might have, like, he's going to have a real stress in spirituality. But what's interesting about his father is his father wasn't really a believer. So Jung thought this was this gap between what you show the world and who you are on the inside. And closing that gap, making those two things closer together is what authenticity is all about. And he thought that at a very young age. So this, his father being so paradoxical, like most people, like most of us on some level, was an interest to him. And his father had some real mental health issues because, you know, here he is putting forward this idea, I'm a pastor, this is my whole identity, yet inside he's something completely different. His mother is not much different, right? So she is... you know, she follows the repressive nature of the Victorian time, you know, pretending to be devout, but also she's in private considered to be a bit of a clairvoyant. So like sort of like a spiritualist type person. Yeah. Right. So there's Jung at a very young age is seeing the duality of people, right? How we have, there's two sides of us and that's going to come out quite a bit later on. People, that's just who we are, right? We have two very different, there's polarity in us. So, and what he would come to think is that this needs to be integrated into one. People need to find balance. That's what it's all about. Like his theories are going to be all about finding balance. Okay. So another important component for Jung is that he thought that there's going to be inevitable pain in everyone's life. And the best thing that you can do is seek a balance between the joy and the pain. Not try to have only joy or not just sitting your pain, but understand that life is kind of about suffering. And the power that you do have is you can kind of choose that the way you're going to suffer in your life. And that's pretty powerful, right?
Yeah.
So the form of therapy he comes up with, and I'm almost done on this little biography here, is called analytical psychology. Now, think about being Sigmund Freud, who is the predecessor, right? They're friends and everything. But you have – the name of your theory is psychoanalysis. You're Freud. And he calls it basically analysis psycho, right? I mean, it's like literally the same thing but mixed around a little bit. So Freud's like, you know, I wonder where you got that from. That's great. But – Jung's concept of therapy is all about making conscious repressed parts of your mind and taking them and integrating with the rest. So getting your unconscious mind to sort of have a relationship with your conscious mind, right? The unconscious and the conscious speaking together. So bringing awareness to the dark side of your mind is going to be a huge part of Jung's ideas. But essentially, Jung just wants you to know why you're doing the things that you're doing. Right? He wants you to better understand yourself.
Okay.
Okay, dude, do you have any questions so far? Because I know I'm being a little bit...
Do I have any questions? No. What? Ask.
I mean, well, I mean, like, I know so a lot of times, like, you know, just jump in on anything here, because sometimes we'll just start rambling and not know if it's a good time.
Sometimes.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the psyche, because this whole thing is going to be set up a little bit differently the way that Freud set it up. Because when we talk about Freud, we talk about the unconscious mind and the conscious mind. So that's pretty cut and dry there, right? Yeah. But it's way more than that for Jung. It's more than id, ego, superego. It's more than just the unconscious and the conscious. So he took what Freud had kind of given us and expanded on it quite a bit. So if you remember that in the dream episode, we talked about how Jung had the dream that he walked downstairs and found Freud in the basement. And what Jung did was found another door, and the basement expanded like so huge.
Yeah.
All right. So this is, I don't even know if he really had that dream, or if this is just his way of saying, like, I think that Freud's onto something, but it's much bigger than that.
Yeah.
So first, let's talk about the conscious mind. So the ego, I know you've heard of that, but this is sort of different, right? It's the center of the conscious mind, just like in Freud's setup. And it gives us our sense of reality. So your memories, your thoughts, and your feelings. It's what we consider our, like, ourself, our consciousness. Like, it's hard to explain. This stuff is all kind of wishy-washy. But Jung thinks that it's relatively weak when compared to our unconscious mind. Again, very similar to Freud. So this is where it starts to get a little more complicated. The persona is a part of the just the regular conscious mind. And this is the idealized side of ourselves, like the superego. But a common modern term for this is something. So you've heard people say masking, right?
Yeah.
It's just like this idea that something that conceals like how we really feel, our true feelings in any specific moment. Because, Dave, we can't just go around showing people exactly how we feel all the time, because we would be a social pariah. No one would want to hang out with us. It can sound inauthentic that we have a persona, but it's not really inauthentic. It's sort of a compromise. I actually don't think it's inauthentic at all. I think it's our persona is this relationship between the internal and external world and how we choose to reveal ourselves.
I think the persona makes more sense once you discuss the unconscious mind, which you're going to get to in a minute, okay. Because that will explain why you're choosing certain things.
Right. Yes. Okay. So I guess I will get into the unconscious mind. Now, the unconscious mind, as far as Jung sees the unconscious mind, right? So this is separate from Freud,
yeah.
But obviously very borrowed. So the unconscious, now Jung agreed with Freud as far as, you know, the iceberg metaphor, right? Our conscious is just at the top. We don't really know a whole lot about what's going on. But Freud had this weird, everything's driven by like repressed sexuality, just kind of all dark ideas. Like you're just constantly repressing everything that you're repressing about yourself is sort of negative. Jung takes a slightly more positive approach. And he thinks that also in the subconscious is, you know, your spirituality, your creativity, this fantasy world.
It's your drive. It's like,
yeah.
The drive to do things, to create, to whatever.
So, yes, and it's not just the unconscious mind. So there's the unconscious mind is two part. It's actually more than two part, but you can break it up into two very specific parts. And one is the collective unconscious and the other is the personal unconscious, right? So this is where it gets kind of interesting. The collective unconscious, it's just like what it sounds. It's also this really trippy idea that in our mind, we're not just, okay, let me try to explain it like this. I'm sorry. You know, when we say we're talking to someone who has anxiety and we're telling them that, you know, or they had a trauma and they are anxious or they're having a panic attack because they don't understand why they're so worked up in the moment. Mm-hmm. And we try to explain to them, well, maybe your unconscious, which is always kind of recording everything around you, it's noticing things, it's seeing things, and it's kind of taking notes to make sure that you don't get yourself hurt, right? So it's this is the collective unconscious, except that it's what human beings as a species have learned throughout their entire evolution. So it's thoughts that are put into our mind that we've passed down from human to human throughout our existence, right?
So you know what's so crazy? He feels like a strong advocate for the idea of generational trauma.
Absolutely.
And it, you know, I never really, it feels like such like a new age term that people throw around. And I always will reference the people that I feel kind of roll their eyes when we use terms like that. But like, it's just a term to describe something that's already, you know, a theory that's already existed.
Yeah. And you can really see how he could connect this to spirituality too, because it's like knowledge that's been given to us somehow before we were even born. So how do you explain that? I mean, I guess you can kind of explain that in an evolutionary type of way, but I don't know. That's pretty wild. That's why he likes Plato a lot. And so did, you know, most of the Christian philosophers, because it does, his ideas do sort of lend to this spiritual world. So the collective unconscious also contains, you know, myths, images, symbols, dreams, and archetypes, like we'll talk about. These are shared by us all, though, right? These myths, when you look at myths throughout cultures, they're pretty close, right? Like what is that about? Like, why are we all kind of telling the same stories before we've ever come in contact with each other? It's kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah.
And so that's the collective unconscious. The personal unconscious is obviously similar to the collective, but just unique to the individual, our memories, our emotions, these things that influence our behavior that we're just kind of unaware of. So we're going to have our own symbols and dreams, but they're going to be very specific to ourselves. So when you think about like a symbol that's sort of a universal symbol, the only thing I'm thinking of like a cross, I'm thinking of even the Red Cross, right? That's sort of a symbol that we see. And it's hard for me to think of one that,
although the Wu-Tang sign,
right? It crosses cultures. And you know, sometimes I'll read like a short story, or in the book The Alchemist, there's symbols in that are very specific just to that story. So that would be sort of a good way to explain the collective unconscious versus the personal unconscious. One is, you know, us as humans, we share an unconscious mind. Whoa, for a second, right? Talk about connectivity. We all share an unconscious mind. And then we just sort of add onto it with our own personal. That's really deep, right? Like this way, when I think of Jung, I'm like, everyone else is wearing a shirt and tie and he's wearing like a wizard hat. You know?
It's also hard to argue against in a way.
It is.
It's so heady and like, I don't even really like know that I can fully even wrap my head around this entire concept.
Well, hold on. Let's think about it like this, right? Everyone says things like beauty is in the eye of the beholder, right? But I think for the most part, if you're staring at a sunset or something like that, there's a reason why we all see that as beautiful. Like we all agree that that's beautiful. We all sort of see the same things as creepy, right? Like no one watches a horror movie and like, oh, that's pretty cute. That's cute. It's like we all see the same things as scary. We all see the same things as beautiful, relatively speaking. Obviously, there's, you know, nuance there.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We are born with some, there's some things that we just, it's almost like we have a memory of a past life.
And it's basically, it's arguing that there's like, not everything can be taught. Like, so you can't be taught that something like, for it would be impossible for every single person to be taught that same message is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So not everything is taught. Some things are
caught
or
intrinsic. Yeah.
It's like I said, it's such a complicated thing. It's like, I don't even know what my argument would be against that.
it's very Platonic. So if you're, you know, if you've never seen a palm tree, or I draw a palm tree, I draw a fir tree, I draw a maple tree, and like, you know, five other trees, because I'm running out of ideas for trees. And I just kind of, they all kind of look different. And I somehow, even though you've never seen any of them, you would say, those are all trees, right? Because there's something we just automatically know. We do have knowledge that was given to us before birth, or we're just born with it. It's strange. It's strange. And yes, he picked up on that. And I don't know, that's kind of wild. But anyways, I digress. That's the unconscious mind. Obviously, we're talking about something here. We're talking about Jung here, a person that we're not going to be able to touch everything in this podcast. But we're going to do our best to touch on what we find, you know, most interesting.
Sure. So that brings us to something called psychological types. And this is something that suggests that people experience the world using four principal psychological functions, those being sensation, intuition, feeling, and thinking. In Jung's eye, one of these is dominant for a person most of the time. So each of these cognitive functions expressed primarily in introverted or extroverted form. So here is a few of those would look like. So we have thinking versus feeling. That's the dichotomy of how people make decisions. And you know what's funny? This is like kind of a first learned for me, but I've literally had this exact theory about after just talking to people for long periods of time. And I think I shared that thought with you a while ago, but I labeled it differently. I talked about like this concept that I had of like engineer brain versus like emotional brain. And that's exactly what this is. Like when I talk to people who are like engineer brain, quote unquote, I say that because I had this one first patient who was an engineer and his brain, the way his thought process worked was so matter of fact. It was like this plus this equals this. And there was no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It had to be that. And if it was anything outside of that, it would not make sense to him and he would get very upset. And his partner was emotional brain. And that's exactly what this is describing. So thinking individuals make decisions based on logic and objective considerations. Feeling individuals make decisions based on subjective and personal values. Is one better than the other? That's not what he's saying. It's just saying one of these things would be dominant for most people.
But if you had to say, which one is better?
Moving on. Sensing versus intuition. So this is the dichotomy that concerns how people perceive or gather information. So sensing individuals focus on present realities, tangible facts, and details. They are practical and literal thinkers. Intuitive individuals focus on possibilities, interconnections, and future potential. They are often abstract and theoretical thinkers. What are you, Greg? Are you sensing or an intuition?
I'm an intuition.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. It's just, I just have an intuition.
Tell us, Greg. Tell us now.
I don't know. I think I'm way more of a feeling versus logical person. And, you know, and I think you might be the opposite.
You think I'm logical?
Yeah.
You're the first person to ever call me logical, I think.
Well, when we talk about things, so let me lay this on you, right?
Lay it down, Greg. Lay it down.
I think in a sense, as human beings, we're all just a little bit more believing. So if I said two scenarios to you, one being you came home, well, I came home from work today and my house was leveled and they had installed a farm and they were planting corn in my yard versus when I was at my grandfather's funeral, I saw an orb floating over his casket. Which story is more believable?
Neither of them. They both sound like a crock of shit.
See, most people would say the orb is much more believable, right? Even though the rest is completely based in facts, and the, you know, I find that interesting, and it's also interesting how you're talking about Jung, and since his mother and his father both, you know, we're putting one thing out into the world and behaving completely different. A lot of his setup to his therapy is about dichotomy, about polarizing views, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yep. It's interesting.
So the next one is extroversion versus introversion. This pair concerns where people derive their energy from. Extroverts are oriented towards the outer world, tend to be more outgoing and sociable, deriving energy from interaction with others and external environment, while introverts are oriented towards inner world. And they tend to be quiet and reserved and derive their energy from reflection, inner feelings, ideas, and experiences. And
what's interesting about that is we all know extroverts and introverts. And what's beyond interesting is those words, those came from Jung.
Yeah.
That's like his idea. So that's a contribution, would you say? I mean, that's huge.
So there's another one that's added into here called there's judging versus perceiving. And that's judging means a person organizes all their life events and as a rule sticks to their plan, while perceiving means being inclined to improvise and explore alternative options. So Jung uses terms dominant, auxiliary, inferior, in which he has like the dominant function. There's two auxiliary functions and one inferior function. If you're not understanding what I'm saying, that doesn't really matter. Because essentially, what this contribution really does lead up to is, you know, there's things like we have that Myers-Briggs type personality type indicator. So, and there's other, I think, personality inventories or surveys, I guess you would say, that kind of use this frame to help you identify your personality type, right? And these are all based on the ideas of Jung. So this was a major contribution to something that's still used today. The scoring for that whole Myers-Briggs thing, the MBTI, is a little weird. I don't like, I would have to actually do it in order to fully say that I understand it. But basically, you take this questionnaire to measure your psychological preferences and how you perceive the world and make decisions. And then they assign you a type compound of four letters, such as like ESTP, which would be what? Extrovert, sensing, what's the T? I already forget. something, you know, thinking and what? Then perceiving, I guess. Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. Like it's
that's saying. What I'm saying too. This is, it's very heady and difficult and, you know, esoteric for a form of therapy.
I mean, I guess taking the Myers-Briggs, like I'm curious, Greg, what do you think would be a reason for someone to take the Myers-Briggs?
I think a good reason.
I could tell you, I could just look at that list and I can tell you where I fit into each of those.
No, what I think it's
probably tell you what's more dominant of me.
What's useful for those tests, I think, is for people, maybe employers.
I was literally going to say that because that's been a big thing. Definitely more recent is companies using those for their employees to kind of help people understand their work stuff, like work personality, their skill set. That's been a big thing. I just actually did one recently to identify like my qualities or whatever it was. And, you know, I guess that makes people feel good when they're in the workplace to kind of know where they fit in and how to work with others, where their strong points are, where they may lack versus their coworkers.
Yeah, there's such a strong influence on people trying to figure out exactly who they are. The problem with that, though, is it's a moving target. It's constantly shifting and changing. So your personality type, I think, like yourself, quotes, it's hard to sort of, isn't it shifting?
Do you think that those things, though, the things that were identified in what I just listed, do you think those things shift?
Yeah, you know what?
I don't think someone goes from being an introvert to suddenly, like, 10 years later, suddenly they're an extrovert. They can probably force themselves to be more extroverted.
Well, that's what Jung's idea would try to be, is to sort of find balance between the two. Yeah.
Like, know? I personally am probably more of, like, a feeling thinker, and I would probably have to force myself to look at things a little bit more matter of fact or logically at times. I get it. Like that's the point. But I don't think that stuff changes. The archetypes, the Jungian archetypes, those might change over time.
Do you talk a little bit about those bad boys?
Yeah, so those are interesting. So he believed that there are these universal experiences that are inherent to the human experience, such as belonging, love, death, fear. And that these are experiences which he calls the collective unconscious, are expressed in what he calls archetypes. So he believes that the archetypes are influenced by evolutionary pressures and manifest in the behaviors and experiences of individuals, and that they are thought to be the basis of many of the common themes and symbols that appear in stories, myths, and dreams across different cultures and societies, mm-hmm. as well as also kind of being the roles that we end up falling into. So the concept that refers to universal inherited idea, pattern of thought, or image that is present in collective unconscious is something that's in all human beings. So it's not just like one population, it's everybody is what he's kind of saying. And that he also believes that the archetypes are innate patterns of thought and behavior that strive for realization within an individual's environment. So it's something that's like, you want, it wants to be expressed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the process of actualization influences a degree of individuation, which we'll talk about more, yep. I'm sure, or the development of the individual's unique identity. So there are 12 of these archetypes, and they are, they're kind of categorized in groups. So there's the first group being ego types, and I'll list off a couple. And Greg, why don't you pick a couple that you want me to go a little bit more in detail about? Because there's 12, okay. So that would take forever to go in detail on all of them. So the first one is the innocent. The next one is the everyman. Oh, let me give a brief description of what the innocent is. This is someone who's like the personification of positivity, sincerity, and purity. They embody everything that's good. And yeah, they're just sometimes
like
though.
Like a child almost.
Yeah, but they're just that person that just seems so pure. And the downfall of them though is sometimes they feel like they've been sheltered, or they've almost like they've been untouched by like the hardships of the world. You know what I mean? So that can be kind of the downfall of the innocent. The next one is the everyman. So this is interesting because I thought it was going in one direction, then it kind of actually turns into something positive. So this person is normal in every way, but he also shows what the best of what normal can be. So it's not like boring, but he can often be overlooked. And
Bilbo Baggins. This is like The Hobbit.
Yeah, Bilbo Baggins. Freaking Bilbo.
Yeah.
But I mean, he's down to earth. He's authentic. He's honest. He's just blah, though. He's bland, you know?
Yeah. No, you know what's interesting is
vanilla, baby.
As he's vanilla. Yeah, I like that. As you're going through these archetypes, it's like, it's important to know that this is all like, is young, influential. Okay. So these archetypes are going to make up, Joseph Campbell's going to get a hold of these things, you know, that the hero's journey guy. And he's going to write a whole book about, you know, the hero's journey using Jung's ideas of archetypes. I mean, and George Lucas is going to read that book. Well,
but Jung's saying that these existed, have always existed. He's saying these are the basis for like our symbols, our stories. He's extracting these from other stories, though.
Right.
And that's
but it's
what
interesting
I think is
that he's he's saying, like, so there's the, you know, Gilgamesh, there's Homer, you know, the Iliad, the Odyssey, there's you know, Virgil and Dante, and they all tell these like hero's journey stories, and he's saying, wait a minute, there's like specific encounters that each of these heroes have to go through, whether outside or inside of themselves, and he picked those out. He did something with the story that no one else had done yet. That's really interesting.
All right, are you done?
Yeah.
Number three.
Okay.
We'll get done with these soon.
Yeah.
All right. So the hero, I mean, that one's pretty self-explanatory, but the weakness of the hero would be what? Arrogance. Sometimes takes on too much responsibility, things like that. Number four, the caregiver. So that's pretty self-explanatory. They're very selfless. They put other people's needs before their own. But as you can, you know, assume, the weakness would also be they can easily be taken advantage of, or they may lack ambition. The next group of types is the soul types. So the first one being the explorer. So this is someone who suffers from constant wanderlust, and that's a great thing to suffer from, I would say.
Yeah.
Well, or is it? So their strength is courage and curiosity, but this curiosity can lead them to being rootless and untrusted by those around them.
Yeah, and who does that remind you of? The Romani.
Oh, or serial killers.
Oh, boy. Have we said those at the same time?
Yeah. So they may find it hard to fit in with others, or have and they may have an irrational fear of being caged into one place for too long.
Mm.
Wasn't there a movie about like a person who like Julia Roberts like keeps running at the altar?
Runaway Bride.
Runaway Bride. She was the explorer.
Yep. She was
He based this archetype.
Yeah.
He based this archetype on Julia Roberts in The Runaway Bride. Oh my
Obviously.
God. It's crazy. All right. The next one is the rebel. So this person doesn't like the way the world is and sets out to do something about it. That's awesome. But guess what? I love how there's like this. I love it. I love
everything. Yeah.
The flip side on all of these. Because they're so it's so true though. So they may walk a very fine line between doing the wrong things for the right reasons and losing themselves in the fight for the cause. And I think that's an important thing for a lot of people to remember at times.
Right. Yeah. So it's like every person's sort of identifying with these in some way. I think Jung would have been really good at writing horoscopes too, because he's doing that thing where he's kind of like, you know, you're really strong and confident, but also you get a little sad sometimes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like,
exactly.
No kidding.
Right. The lover is the next one. And this person, I mean, we already did an episode on borderline, and that's what I feel like he's describing. They crave connection from others above all else, whether it's a partner, dear friend, or tight-knit family. The obvious downfall of this, you know, they're passionate, sensual, loyal, but they have this deep fear of being left alone, which can cause them to overstretch themselves and sacrifice too much in the pursuit of love. Yeah. All right. The creator, the artist, delights in bringing order to chaos, whether that's chaos out in the world or chaos within themselves, through creative endeavors, drawing, writing, music, whatever. They have potential to affect enormous change in the world. They also run the risk of losing themselves in it.
Yeah.
Kind of similar to the rebel or the outlaw. Just kind of getting lost in something.
Yeah.
The next group is the self types. The first one being the jester, like spreading joy, loves a good laugh, you know, who doesn't?
Defense mechanism.
Totally. He's totally a sad clown underneath it all. But so everybody knows them as the jester. So they rarely open up to reveal them their true selves because they've cultivated this distinctive and satisfying persona.
Mm-hmm.
It feels better to be the jester than to be Greg. The next one is
true. That's the last archetype, the Greg. No one wants to be that archetype.
All right, the next one is the sage, passionate about learning and constantly working to improve their mind and their spirit. They want to continually grow and understand the truth of everything, but they can too easily lose themselves in studying minute details and maybe unwilling to trust themselves to take any real action, encouraging others to do so in their place.
Too focused. You can be too focused.
You can. Only two more. The magician is great power, knowledge, skill. He's like a wizard. Can be charismatic and often well-loved. Their weakness lies in their arrogance and their occasional tendency to overestimate themselves. And the last one is the ruler, natural-born leader, big ambitions, charismatic. They have a knack for understanding interpersonal politics. But since they know how to use these skills and they're aware of these skills, that can also cause them to be suspicious and paranoid about how others can use those skills. And that can be a weakness used against them as well. So,
interesting.
These are super interesting for so many reasons, but like I feel like there's probably a number of them that we could fall into at different times. Like you said, I feel like this feels more like something that could change over time, like in different phases of our lives. Because as we all know, like our personalities change over time. Like we're not the same person we were 5 years ago. We're definitely not the same person we were 10 years ago. If you are, you're weird.
Mm.
And I don't
You're not growing.
I don't trust you either.
Yeah.
you're a robot. No, I'm just kidding. But like, that would be weird to be the same person that you are 10 years ago, because we have all this experience and all this new knowledge.
So then why is that people put so much emphasis on saying like, I'm not feeling myself. I'm not, I don't know who I am. It's like, well, who do you want to be? And these archetypes kind of help you decide. Like, what's interesting about them is like, all right, well, I have a piece here, a piece here, and a piece here. Like, I'm sort of this.
Yeah. Greg, that was such a unintentionally like smart question.
Now I'm unintentionally smart.
No, but like that's such a great question to ask. Like, people do get hung up on that, right? They get like, who am I? What am I doing? And in that moment, it's so hard to figure that out. Like, it feels unattainable to be able to figure that out.
Because there's even an argument saying there is no self. Like, that's an illusion, which I don't agree with. Because here we are, you know, choosing to have a conversation about the self. What I think the self is just our collected values and, you know, the choices that we make with those values.
Yeah.
And also, like, some part of it is orienting yourself with a future that looks good to you and making the decisions you have to make to get there. That's like what a self is.
Right.
And that's why it's constantly changing.
And it's the question, the response that you gave is perfect, because it's like, well, who do you want to be? But like, for some reason, that feels like a really hard conclusion to get to sometimes, like in different periods of our lives, right? Mm-hmm. Especially when we don't really truly understand that, like, you're in the driver's seat. It's not going to just dawn on you. You have to start making moves and taking actions in order to figure out who you are. First, you have to identify your values. And if you don't know what your values are, maybe just start dabbling in some things and see how it feels.
Or Dave, another thing you can do is,
it's not your value.
If you're having trouble finding your values, you might look outside yourself. You might say, well, who do I admire? And when you figure out who you admire, like, what is it about them that I admire? Like, what things that are they doing that makes them admirable to me? Like, what do I like about them?
Yeah.
So that could help you identify your values too. And like you said too, you're not going to know who you are until you start making moves, because you find out by action, by making the wrong decisions, really.
Yeah. Right? You can't feel one way or another if you just make no action, right?
Yeah.
You can't know if something is, you know, feels wrong if you didn't take an action. You can't know if something feels good if you don't take an action. You have to make some sort of action. So Greg,
yeah,
we have to get to the part about kind of like the choices we make, the masks that we wear, and what that means in Jungian theory.
Okay.
How do we get to that point right now?
Well, right now, actually, I guess for me, I don't know how we get to that.
I think that we can maybe take some of these archetypes and you maybe use that as a little bridge to there. Because I do think we need to get to that. Because that stuff's super important, but also interesting. I think people will find that fascinating. So for our personality, basically personality is the way how would you describe it in Jungian theory? It's the choices we make, the persona we put on.
Yeah.
Is that personality is part of our persona?
Ironically, after that conversation, it's like, you know, Nietzsche says something, he says that we're all actors of our ideal self. So it's like the persona we put on is the way we want people to view us.
Yes.
But that's not necessarily who we feel like we are on the inside.
Yes, exactly. And so the persona, this is, I think, super important, because I think this part right here kind of brings up a lot of good talking points. So the persona, how we present ourselves to the world. So it's basically the social mask that we wear in all the various domains of our lives, right? So at work, I'm wearing a mask. At home, I'm wearing a certain mask, or maybe I can let my mask off, but that's also kind of my mask, right? If I go see friends, I might be wearing a certain mask. And when I say mask, a social mask contains all the primitive urges, impulses, emotions that aren't considered to be socially acceptable or aren't appropriate for whatever that domain is, right?
Yeah.
So like, I can act a certain way if I'm with friends or if I'm with family, but I cannot act at work, most likely, right?
So, and people might, that sounds inauthentic as shit.
But it's not.
But it's not.
It's not. And that's why I find this to be so fascinating. And it's also 100% true. Because if I acted the same exact way with my friends that I do at work, I am losing my job tomorrow.
Right.
And I don't want to necessarily do that. Or I'm not going to be effective at my job or whatever. It's basically the mask is our filter.
Right.
It's like I get a thought and it's the thing that tells me, hey, it's okay to do that thought, that thing here. Or, hey, don't do that thing here because that's not appropriate, Dave. Don't ever do that here, actually. Don't even do that at home because it's not appropriate there either. Right? It's like...
Right. No. And sometimes you have to put on a mask to follow those. You have to put on a mask to be authentic. Now, like I was just thinking, as you're saying that, I'm thinking of something. You know, we've talked a million times about like the Holocaust, but I don't even have to go that deep. Like, so say you're a teenager in school and you're watching someone get bullied and you're kind of a quiet guy, but you have to say, you know what? This is going against every value I have. So I'm going to put on a brave face and pretend I'm not afraid of that guy. Is that inauthentic? No, not at all. It's you being as authentic as possible by putting that mask on, right?
Right.
It's just, you know, it's those masks that you have to wear around other people is more self-awareness than anything.
And you know what? I think the only flaw with this whole idea is the fact that we're even using the term mask because of what mask has turned into. I think if like we didn't have that whole idea of like, oh, I'm masking my depression by putting a smile on my face. That's not what we're talking about here. The mask is literally in a better sense, it's like it's my jacket, right? Yeah. Or it's my coat or it's my suit. Or it's whatever, it's my uniform for this place, right? So the thing that he warns people about, though, is becoming too closely identified with whatever mask or archetype that you're, you know, it just one of them. Because we have very like different types of archetype types in different places or masks in different places. And he, for once, said it's dangerous to get like overinvested in just one. And you know what that brought up for me?
Wow.
And just to explain, like what I'm saying is like, I'm not just like, you're not just a podcast host. You're also a therapist kind of, and you have another job and I'm
just, yeah. We're
and,
all,
and you're things. Also, you're a dad and you know, you're a son and you know, you're a brother and you're so many different things. Right. But if you were just Greg, the therapist, you know,
and if that failed, like that's why it's right.
Okay. What does that remind you of?
I diversify your identity. I think I've said that before,
but what episode was that? Things Fall Apart.
Yeah.
We talked about Okonkwo and his over-identification in his role as like the leader or the strong guy of his tribe. And then when that image no longer fit what was happening in his society, he fell apart. Right. And I think that's such a great example of what
it's perfect, actually. And the name really, I don't know if he did that on purpose, but things do fall apart, you know?
Yes.
You can't have one point of failure.
Absolutely.
You know, Dave, is there something else I can bring up too? Just because what I find is that's sort of what you find most fascinating about Jung. Now, can I say what I find most fascinating about
him? I believe I was just about to get us there. So why don't you take the lead on that one? Actually.
Okay. For me, this shadow work, in fact, like Dave and I have had this idea and like where it's, you know, I consider this our baby. I'm teaching it at PC right now, but it's in development, but it's this idea of, it's dark psychology, but the importance of us all and our shadows. So like Jung talks about shadow integration and there's parts of all of us, you know, traumatized parts, sad parts, a mean parent. It doesn't have to be this super traumatic thing, right? Like a divorce, a bully, it doesn't really matter, but it doesn't really bother us because we lock it away. And picture this too. Let's get Jungian for a second. We lock it away in a wardrobe. We put a chain around it. We lock it all up. And then we wonder why we don't feel complete, right, as people. But we've told ourselves that danger is locked away. But what's going on inside that shadow, what's going on inside that wardrobe is still has power in our lives, right? So think about it like this. If I put my kids in a room and lock the door, things are going to go on in there, right?
Yeah.
But if I leave it there, that's dangerous. That you could, like, it's ironic that I'm like kind of associating my kids with darkness. But if I put my darkness somewhere and don't look at it, it's way more dangerous than if I open the door and look at it. Like, you know, if you get a bee in your car, do you want to let that thing go wherever it wants? No, your power is by knowing where that is. So talk about my kids again, if there's a monster under the bed or, you know, I want to banish that darkness. What do? We shine a light on it. And what's a great metaphor for that? It's just, that's just looking at it, right? Mm-hmm. And what Jung wants us to do is to look at that darkness, accept it, and integrate it into our lives. Like, he has this whole idea that, you know, a tree can't reach to heaven unless its roots go down to hell. So what he's saying is you can't really be good unless you acknowledge the bad parts about you and sort of fight against that.
And this concept, you could see how he and Freud would probably butt heads.
Yeah.
Because Freud's idea of what our darkness is would be only sexual, only like perverted things, right?
Right.
And Jung's saying it could be more than just that, though. It could be more. Just anything that just like isn't stuff that can maybe come out all the time. And you have to find a way to be able to meet that need at some point.
That's absolutely right. Like, if you were, you know, say it was a bully and you kind of had those feelings and you locked that away, and now that bully's locked away in that wardrobe or stuffed away somewhere that you're not looking at anymore, but you're still behaving in a way as that bullied kid. Like, you don't go into certain situations. You're carrying some anger with you. So in a way, that bully's staying with you locked away, but he's still controlling your behavior. But if you open the door and you look at that bully, the person you are now, maybe you can face it better. You can come to terms with that. And now you live your life differently because you integrate that darkness into you, right? It's post-traumatic growth in a sense, right?
It would really be interesting, though, to hear Jung talk to someone about, like, well, what if my dark thing is, like, it really should probably just not come out. Like, it is this thing. Like, yeah. I wonder what his guidance would be for that person. Like, how do you integrate that?
Oh, you're talking about, like, maybe like a weird serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer thing, right?
Or, yeah, this, like, some kind of weird fetish that maybe could be potentially, like, dangerous. Or,
well, if you hide from it, it'll grow, and then one day you just snap and then you like act out on it, right? So
yeah, I have an example, and I don't want to give too much detail on it, but I do have an example, and it's like, I wish I had an idea of what Jung would say to this person.
Yes,
because this person had been pushing and hiding a lot of like sexual fetishes for a long time, and at one point in his life, it kind of came out, I guess, with his partner, and he dabbled. And now, and then he got it a little bit, it immersed itself too much in his life. And it went down a path that, you know, in my talks with him, kind of knew it was going to go down. I had forewarned him many times, like, if you continue to go this road, I feel like something's going to not go well for you at some point. And I wish you would make a different choice, or you would contain this a little bit. And then, you know, the next thing I know, things got a little bit out of control, and him and his partner are having significant troubles. And now he's in this place where he's like, he doesn't know what to do with his life. And I'm like, is that just a product of overindulging in that dark place? Or is it more of an issue with, like, maybe that he should have found a different way to express that side of himself? I don't know. What would y'all
think? And I don't even know if it's about indulging. It's about acknowledging. You know, it's
that acknowledging that it's there.
Yeah.
If you just acknowledge, is that still kind of letting it stay dormant? If you don't ever express it? Because I think what he says mm-hmm. is, like, you have to find a way sometimes to, you may need to meet certain needs, right?
Right.
But like, you have to find a
way. Like, you have to find a way.
Yeah. You have to find a way that doesn't conflict with your persona. Because then if it conflicts with your persona, your whole gimmick's up, right?
Yeah, that's true. Your gimmick's up. You don't want that.
No. And he talks about defense mechanisms, but it sounds like he talks about defense mechanisms more in like a useful way versus what we consider defense. Like, I think, you know, in our role, we often think of defense mechanisms as like maladaptive, bad, like behaviors that people do to like avoid things or...
Yeah, when really a lot of them aren't.
Yeah.
So repression is... Right. So that's like Freud's thing, but like sublimation, like maybe, you know, you have like making a, like writing a dark poem or making a dark movie.
I heard a great example of someone who's like got a lot of rage inside of them, but using that, somehow transforming that anger into like motivation and like competitive spirit or something along those lines, you know, that'd be a great defense mechanism.
Right. Yeah. No, anytime you can use it, like take something dark and turn it into a positive. I mean, that's great, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it doesn't get talked about enough. Like in some, like when we talked about Santa Claus, most cultures do have a darker component, and I think it's just reality to kind of acknowledge that there is a darker part of it.
Yeah.
This is, you know, where do we go from here? Do you want me to talk about the treatment?
No. So there's still self too. So that represents the unified unconscious and the unified conscious and unconscious of an individual. So that takes everything from the collective unconscious and it like kind of informs it with the conscious and puts it together in a way that kind of says like, this is how I should be. These are my desires. This is what I want. So like, it's like taking everything we just discussed and this is individuation, right? Which you kind of describe. But then there's this idea of, and do you know anything about this? Anima or
anima and animus. Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting too, because this is another part of Jung taking things that like are so present in today's society. And like, this is like obviously not recent stuff that he's talking about here, but it's like it was already present back then, and he's all about exploration and not denying parts of ourselves. So how do you say the word again? Is it anima?
Anima and animus.
Anima is a feminine image in a male psyche, and animus is a male image in a female psyche. So we're talking about what represents the true self versus the image we present to others. And his idea about this is he felt discouraging exploration of these alternative gender aspects would stunt the growth of individuals.
Right.
So I thought that was interesting because, like, I mean, this comes up a lot today, obviously. It's, you know, there's a lot of controversy over gender roles and, you know, the way we express gender and things like that. But he's basically saying you have to explore it, because if you don't, you're denying yourself growth and development. And like a lot of the way you look at it is going to be that conscious and unconscious influence. So like we talked about, kind of like the messages maybe passed down from in society or from in just our family, but also our experiences over time. And that's kind of how we're going to really be able to explore it.
Now you bring up something interesting, how it does seem like he needs the unconscious and dreams and, you know, even like the ideas of schizophrenia, everything has like meaning and purpose to it. But did you know that he had multiple psychotic breaks throughout his life? So that he kind of really wanted those things to mean something, because he had been seeing like dead people and visions, and you know, shortly after that was World War One, and he's like, am I, like, does this stuff really mean something? Can you imagine like grappling with that when you're, you know, you're a high level psychiatrist and you're having your own mental breaks? It's almost like, is he looking too much into the psyche that it's kind of, like Nietzsche has that great quote, right? If you look into the abyss long enough, it stares back, or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
It's a scary idea. It's also like he is so heady. This stuff is so deep and hard to explain and hard to get into. And there's so much of it, right? We haven't even scratched the surface. We could probably talk about this, you know, forever.
But we won't.
But we will not. Should I start talking about a little bit of how this is a treatment? This won't take long, because this is, I mean, This for us, we kind of joked around last time about how if you go to Dave and I, we liked the short term, you know, maybe 8-session CBT therapy, but we're both sort of certainly down for that long road approach too, right? And that's what you're dealing with Jung. It's more of a spiritual enlightenment, right? It reminds me of Buddhism more than anything else, because it's about resolving inner conflicts, balance, and integration of the conscious and the unconscious. Like, he wants he thinks that your unconscious mind knows that your conscious mind exists, like, intrinsically. It's its own sort of entity, but the conscious mind is unaware of everything that the unconscious is doing. And he wants those two components of your psyche to be able to kind of conversate with each other, which is interesting, right? So when you have a dream, you're like, what is my, and we've talked about this before with dreams, like, you're trying to learn the language of the unconscious. And that's what he's, like, his whole approach is constantly trying to learn what your unconscious mind is trying to tell your conscious mind. And the better you can get at deciphering that language, the healthier you're going to be, right? So again, back to his form of therapy, it's going to be, you know, coping, like we talked about in the beginning, with inevitable pain, a lot of balance. You're going to be happy, you're going to be sad, accept both. The treatment has four phases. It's catharsis, education, elucidation, and transformation. And throughout your therapy sessions, he's going to use symbols, he's going to use dream interpretation, he's going to do word association tests. And one thing I find super interesting, Dave, as if there's not enough, like, layers with this, is he'll use rituals. Like, is that wild? I mean, I find this interesting because historically and for millennia, human beings have had rites of passages. And that's sort of how, like, it's an indicator to us, hey, this is your next stage of development, so act appropriately. We don't really have that anymore. And I think that's not good, right?
Yeah.
So I think that being part of your therapy sessions is pretty sort of, I don't know how you would implement that, but there's obviously a lot of room for creativity with that.
What do you mean we don't have that anymore? Could you give an example?
So, all right, like, you know, it's hard to, I knew you were going to ask something like that. And I knew I should have sat down and thought about some rites of passages. I mean, we have what, like, your first communion, things like that, like graduating from college. I don't know, but we don't have, like, this thing happens and now you're a man, or this thing happens and now you're a woman. Like, every man has to, you know, go through this, you know, stand on a pole for a night, or like hunt something in the wild for a night, like do this rite of passage. And now when you come out the other side of this difficult event, now you're something different.
But let me challenge you a little bit. What was a previous example of that?
I mean, it would have to be tribal if I was going to come up with, like, examples.
So nothing within, like, the last 100 years?
No. And I think that might be the problem. Right? I mean, can you think of any? I'm thinking of, like, bat mitzvahs and stuff like that. But even that, it's not.
Quinceañera.
Yeah, it doesn't rise to the occasion. But that is a marker, though.
It's a big one for different cultures, Greg. Yeah. Just because we don't necessarily have it in our culture doesn't mean.
Yeah, it's a marker
don't.
For sure.
Yeah.
You know, and
we had Sweet 16, but then MTV had that show, and I think it just got out of control, you know?
Yeah.
Everyone's competing with who can have a better Sweet 16, and then. Was it Lil Wayne's daughter had a crazy one?
It sounds like you've seen a lot of those. I can't keep up with that. But obviously, as I talk about this therapeutic approach, there's some serious limitations. First of all, it doesn't even sound like you're not making treatment plans here. You're, like, developing a philosophy for somebody. And the immediate symptoms that sometimes people come in with, there's no sort of attention to that. Like, okay, this is all well and good, like, I want to do some rituals down the road, sure, but, like, what are we going to do about, like, my anxiety? I can't, like, go into social functions, or I can't be around people, or I can't leave the house. Like, what are you going to do about that, right? And there's not a whole lot of empirical research or real interventions that we can sort of try with this. But I think that, all that said, we all use this, right? We all use different components of Jung. I mean, just saying introvert and extrovert, that's, like, common nomenclature. That we just use that every day.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. So what do you think here?
Very interesting. A lot to cover here. Also, just a lot of concepts. So this, I know is probably not for everyone, but there might be some people who are learning about this or who have recently needed to dabble in some Carl Jung, and hopefully this is sort of helpful. Hopefully, I don't know. But yeah, it's a lot. So
it's a lot. And like, you know, even if you wanted to just go Google Carl Jung quotes, and you can go down a rabbit hole with just that. Sure. There's some great stuff just there. Yeah. I mean, did you now, after going through this, Dave, are you more or less of a fan of Carl Jung?
Oh, I mean, I definitely connect and relate and also find that a lot of the concepts he's talking about, I kind of already probably like was like utilizing or kind of even like just thinking for my own life without even really realizing that it was his. I'm definitely aboard the Jung train.
Yeah. I think we can all find parts of Jung that we can use. I mean, just not even as therapists, just as people. But also, and I have read a couple of his books, the Red Book being super interesting. That's one of his later books. They aren't easy to get through, though.
I actually was just at a store, a vintage store the other day, picked up The Undiscovered Self on paperback.
So in that book, The Undiscovered Self, see, this is just Carl Jung, something that like in that little book he talks about, and I've used this with people who are there like, I mean, I just can't find a way to feel normal, right? And then he says, you know, if you grabbed a bag of marbles, or not even marbles, or grab a bag of pebbles, right? And you gathered up all the pebbles you can, you could say that the normal pebble or the average pebble weighs 1.35 grams, right? And that's what a normal, so we can all kind of agree what a normal pebble is. But then if you weighed each one of those pebbles in that entire bag, not one of them would weigh that. They'd all be some variation of close to that. So it's like trying to find to be normal is an impossible task.
So and this person comes to you and is like, I don't know how to feel normal. And now I'm sitting across from some guy who's talking to me about pebbles and how much they weigh.
Yeah.
My life's in shambles.
Yeah. You want to know? You want to know what my normal go-to is? When people say, like, I just, like, I, you know, you get the sense that they just want to feel normal. I always tell them, look at all these books in this office. Not one of them is about a normal person.
Yeah.
Right? I always like to tell people that because no one gives a shit about a normal person, a normal life. That's not doing anybody any favors. Not doing anybody any good. Like, it's the weird, the strange, the unusual, the challenge. Those are the lives we want to hear about. That's what's important in the world.
I usually take my patients for a walk around our office space, and I say, look at all these therapists in this building. Not one of them is normal.
It promises you that. Yeah.
Look at these freaks.
And you know what? There goes another Carl Jung quote when you're talking about that, because he says, knowing your own darkness is the best method for dealing with the darkness of other people. So that's such a beautiful way to say, you know, having been through hard times makes you a better person to be able to talk to, right? You can see someone's anxiety in them, right? Isn't that so true? Like if you've been depressed, you can look at someone and you can see that they're depressed, and you can also really feel for them and you want to help them.
You know, I think that's part of why certain people gravitate to certain professions. You know, working in human services, looking at other people and hearing other people's stories who work in human services, you kind of start to see patterns of why people gravitate to that work. And it's not just one reason. It's a variety of reasons, but it's that exact concept. And I think it's like they feel more useful because they've had certain experiences, or they lacked certain experiences and they're filling some voids with what they're getting out of, you know, working in that field.
Well, you just said something really interesting to me. And lately I've been thinking about
finally,
and I've just been waiting for it, and then took it to like a fucking over an hour into this podcast to say people finding a way to be useful. I think that if you can make somebody useful or creative, that is sort of the path to good mental health. Like, I think people just want to be useful.
Sure. You want to make people useful to you, Greg?
If that helps them.
All right, P. Diddy. All right, moving on.
All right, maybe that's enough. Maybe that's enough for today.
So, long episode, I'm sure. We'll find the running time later. But yeah, like we said, it was a lot to squeeze in to this episode. There is a lot of content on young Carl.
Yeah, and we're leaving a lot on the table too. So you're welcome.
So anyways, everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you made it this far, congratulations. You're one of one who made it this far.
Yeah.
You're the only one. You're alone. So as always, just to recap, you know, we have social media. Greg, help me out here. I'm totally blanking and you're not even paying attention.
Sorry. Sorry.
So you can reach out to us on social media. If you guys want to get in touch, that's always a fun way to get to know people better, to feel more connected to the people listening. I always enjoy hearing people's feedback. But also, we really do encourage and hope that people are willing to leave ratings and reviews. It's super helpful to us getting getting it out to the world. Somehow it helps. I don't know. I don't even know. Algorithms and whatnot. I'm totally stumbling over every word I say right now.
Are you okay?
I'm all alone here.
What archetype? Are you the sleepy? Sleepy?
Yeah. I guess so. Yeah, anyways.
Yeah.
We also have a subscriptions page. We do appreciate beyond words the support. We do plan to build that up over time. It's still in the early development. I say that every episode, but we truly do mean it. So we are hoping to give back at some point rather soonish, but can't give any details on that. So if you're willing, go on our social media or just look up Unconventional Therapist Guide to Nothing and look up the subscriptions page on Buzzsprout, and you can hit up any tier on there. And then lastly, that's all I got. Yes, yeah. Right? Is that it? Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
We'll see you next week. Everyone, have a great night. Thanks for listening. Ciao.
Ciao.
Bon voyage.
I don't know anything. Au revoir.
I don't
bon voyage. That's not goodbye.